Readers Entertainment Radio, where variety is the spice of life.
Hello, and welcome to Readers Entertainment Radio. I'm your host, Sheila English. As we approach Memorial Day, we're given a moment to reflect and remember those in service who have laid their lives on the line for us. For those of us who have no idea what goes on behind the scenes, so to speak, with our servicemen and women, this week's guest will be able to shine some light on the day-to-day lives of those brave soldiers. Please welcome the author of Train to Baghdad, Matt Leatherwood Jr. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you very much, Sheila. It's a pleasure to be with you and your audience.
Now, before we go too far, let me just let our listeners know that this is a pre-recorded session, and that doesn't mean you can't send in some comments or some questions. You absolutely can. As soon as you've listened to this, you can go over to www.readersentertainment.com, and we'll have the podcast up with an additional blog and some URLs, and at that point you can participate in sending your questions there. Post them. We'll make sure that Matt gets any questions or comments and that he responds to you. So you're still able to do that. Now, Matt, let's start with a synopsis of the book. Walk us through the basic story.
Okay, Sheila, the basic story is about a Marine corporal at the tail end of his enlistment. His contract is frozen, preventing him from getting out of the service. He's deployed to Kuwait, and he ends up participating in the 2003 invasion of Iraq. And that time period was from March 20th, 2003, to April 9th, 2003, which was the fall of Baghdad. The title, Train to Baghdad, is shorthand slang for logistical train headed towards Baghdad. The main character finds himself on a logistics convoy supporting the infantry. They're responsible for providing ammo, water, heavy equipment support, and even personnel if the infantry needed it. In this book, I want to put the reader in the battalion at the junior Marine level, let them experience everything from that perspective as it unfolds.
Okay. Now, tell me something. Why is it important to you to tell the story of your average soldier's life?
It's important because for every heroic story and tragedy out there, there are 5 to 10 common stories of ordinary service members who do their job and go home. And nobody ever hears these stories unless they have a personal connection with a service member, and so they kind of like fade into the shadows. Usually when books on military conflicts are released, you get one of two extremes. The first extreme is you get extraordinary circumstances, special forces, covert operations. And then on the opposite end of that parallel, you get a book from the commanding general or policymakers during that time frame. And very rarely do you get a story about the average service member, guy or gal, and the day-to-day activities of what's going on.
Now, how close to true is this story?
This story is 97% true. And I took 3 liberties with this story, and I'm going to go ahead and lay those out. The first liberty I did is I changed the main character's rank. I changed his rank from sergeant to corporal. And the second liberty I took was I changed the main character's job in the military from logistics planner to heavy equipment operator. And the reason why I made those 2 changes is because had I left him as a sergeant in logistics planning, that would have added a whole level of complexity to the story that just didn't need to be there to make the story flow well. And then the last liberty I took was I changed the lead character's siblings from male to female. And that was done to make contact on the home front more endearing during the story. I hold a BS in history, and in the past I've done extensive work with archives, research, and firsthand accounts of historic events. So I know the importance of sticking as close to reality as possible. This book was drawn from 2 journals that I kept. The first journal I started and whispers again going around the battalion that we might deploy to Kuwait. And I kept that journal up until a day prior to the invasion. That first journal I packed away and I put in my sea bag, and it was stored in Kuwait. And I started a second journal once we got underway during the invasion. And then I kept that journal up until the time we got to Baghdad. And the reason why I split the journals was because I was hedging my bets. If anything happened to me, one of those two books would have made it back to my family, and they would have a written record of what I was experiencing on a day-to-day basis. So that's where that came from. Lastly, I want to say that I had to fictionalize the story because when I left active duty, I didn't get any release forms from the people that were involved in this story. And also, I wasn't sure what I could say and what I couldn't say without being in violation of operational security. So the last thing you want is, you know, a knock on the door and two NCIS agents saying, hey, we need to speak to you about some stuff you said in your book. So that's why it is a fictional account based on true events.
Well, and I think it's admirable that you're concerned with, you know, that you don't compromise anybody or anything, you know, with your book. And I think that's great that you have that forethought. Now, talk to us about the relationships that are created when soldiers are deployed, the relationships between the soldiers and maybe even the way that relationships evolve or change between the people left behind and the soldiers.
Relationships formed in combat or high-stress environments are very unique. The situation I found myself in was that I didn't know any of the guys I went to Iraq with, and I know that sounds strange, but what happened was my unit was from the East Coast, and when we got to Kuwait, we married up with our sister unit from the West Coast. So our two battalions were merged together. And then once platoons were being created, personnel were allocated based on their job skill sets and capabilities to round out platoons. It wasn't like, okay, well, these guys are from the East Coast, they need to stay with East Coast people, and these guys are from the West Coast, and they can only be with West Coast people. There was an intermingling going on. So I found myself in strange surroundings with guys that I had never known before. In 45 to 90 days, you get to know people real well. You're eating with these people, you're sleeping with these people, you're conducting hygiene. You're with this person 24 hours a day. You depend on them, they depend on you, so the bonds become very strong. One of the best compliments that I received on this work came from Doc, who was the corpsman in the story. Actually, it came from his mother. I sent his mother a copy of the book, and she read it, and she got back to me a few days later. And what she said about it was, wow, I can't believe that you got my son's attitude and the way he acts 100% accurate. You only knew him for 90 days tops. I've known him for 28 years. How were you able to do that? And that's the type of bonds that combat and high-stress situations provide. All social facades and all that stuff drop because you have to become real with these guys. Your life depends on it. They need to know how you think. You need to know how they think. And you guys have to be on the same sheet of music. A lot of times it's always said that, you know, when service members go to war, they're fighting for freedom, liberty, country, and those are all abstract ideas. When you get down to it, you're fighting for the guy next to you. You're fighting to make sure that Doc gets on the plane to see his wife and his two kids. And so it's actually in reverse. You're fighting for your platoon, your unit, your branch of service, then country, liberty, and all those other abstract ideas. So it actually works in reverse.
And how would you say that relationships change between the people left behind and the soldier who's gone overseas?
That's an added stress because a lot of times with deployments, you know that, okay, my husband or my spouse is going to be away for 6 months. When you run into a situation when you're going into a full onslaught war, you have a general idea, okay, they may be back in a year, they may not. And so what that does is it puts an added stress on the home front because a lot of times spouses find themselves in unfamiliar territories. You know, hey, I got to do this by myself, I got to do that by myself. And they become the provider of the family, the breadwinner, paying the bills, taking care of everything on the home front. So it's almost a reversal of roles there. And a lot of families are not prepared for that. That's an added stress because of things that are going on the home front that the spouse may or may not be able to handle. It's also added stress on the service member that is deployed or on the war front because they're constantly worried about what's going on back home. So the dynamics change. And I think what's important about that is good communication between the two individuals involved.
Okay. Now, how important, you know, we're talking about home, how important is it for a soldier to hear from home when he's away or she's away?
Hearing from home is of the utmost importance, whether it's from email, a letter, satellite phone, it doesn't matter. Word from home is the driving force in the service member's life. It's the one thing that allows them to focus, have a clear mind, and focus on the task that they have to do at hand. It gives them purpose, peace, and motivation if they get that word. The worst thing you want on the battlefield is a divided mindset. So there's no such thing as too much communication. That is the single most thing that you can do, is to communicate with your beloved.
Well, you know, there's a scene in the book that that made me stop and think about this. This is why I included the question. There's a scene about during mail call, and there was one of the soldiers who seemed to get mail all the time and lots of stuff. And I was just kind of touched by the way that you described it. It's like everybody's just waiting to see if one of those letters is going to be for them. And
exactly.
It just seemed like it seems so important, and it actually was very touching to me to have that realization of, wow, do they really stand around, like everybody's standing around hopeful for a piece of mail?
Yes. Like I said, that is the most driving force, is that piece of mail. I mean, it doesn't matter if you just walked the dog and said, hey, went to the park, played with the dog, love you. That's something, because what that does is it sets the mind at ease, because the mindset on the battlefield is, okay, you're going on patrol, what's going on at home, come back from patrol, what's going on home, go to the commander's brief, what's going on at home, got downtime, what's going on home. You're always focused on what's happening at home, and so the more information you can get about what's going on at home and know that everything's all right, that calms the mind. It allows you to focus and to do the mission that's set before you.
Well, you know, that kind of spurs just kind of a little offshoot question. I know that our community will take up, we like adopt a soldier, so it might be somebody that we don't know, but because they're from our community, you know, we'll send packages out to that person and we send books. Is that something that you see a lot of? Is that something that soldiers appreciate?
Oh, yeah, you see a lot of that. In fact, towards the end of the invasion, when we made it back to Kuwait, we had tables full of care packages. I mean, there were so many care packages, they were stacked in the back. And, you know, they really do appreciate that, you know, especially the stuff like baby wipes and insect repellent and those hard-to-get items that you can't normally get. But anything that communicates, hey, we're thinking about you, we support you, you can't go wrong with that.
Well, you know, that kind of answers my next question, but I'm going to ask it anyhow in case you can elaborate. What can we at home do to help?
I think the most important thing that you can do at home is to remain in contact. Again, there's no such thing as too much contact. I think the two ground rules is keep it positive and keep it constant. If you only walk the dog that day, send that postcard or send that email, hey, honey, thinking about you, walk today. Walk the dog today. That's something. And, you know, it's always better to get something than nothing because, again, our thoughts are always on the home front, no matter what we're doing. That home front is in the back of our mind.
Now, did you have help writing this? I know you said you had written journals, you know, or did you have friends or colleagues that gave feedback or suggestions for the book as you were writing it?
No, actually, I was just one of those guys growing up that had talent to write. I, you know, wrote the love letters for friends and wrote stories in class, you know, to do past time. So I had gotten discharged in August of 2003. I made the 8-hour drive home, talked to my family, went to bed, got up the next day, popped open the laptop, and I started writing. And I wrote from August of 2003 till Thanksgiving that year. I was putting in 8 hours a day, and I'll tell you, I will never do that again. In front of a computer, I would never put myself under that kind of pressure. But what surprised me the most was how difficult it was, because not only did I have to make sense of the story, I had to do the civilian to military translations, so that the story would flow and it could be something that my mother would understand. I thought, and I was duped into thinking it was going to be easy because I had these two journals. You know, how hard can it be to copy the journals or whatnot? But there was a lot that went into this, and I was wrong. So when the book came out in 2004, I gave copies to my commanding officer and members of my platoon. And my commanding officer called me up, and he said, hey, you know, thank you for putting the story down on paper. And he said, you know what, it really gave me an insight into how the policies and decisions that I make at a command level affect the junior Marines. And he had never had that before, because when you get up to field grade levels in the military, when you're a colonel, general, major general, you're so far removed from the basic troop that you don't have that insight a lot of the times. And so when he read that, he was like, wow, you know, you really did a good job. So,
well, that's nice. So now what, you know, you talk about giving the book to, you know, to some people that you know. What other kind of feedback are you getting from readers and just your average people?
Just my average people, and this goes for military members too, the feedback's been very positive. The common thread that I'm hearing from a variety of readers is that they love the book because of the detail that it entails. It's the details that puts them in the driver's seat and helps them to live the life of the lead character and to experience things as they unfold. I also took this book and I entered it in the Writer's Digest 2004 self-published book contest. And I did that for, I wasn't looking to get rewards or anything, but I knew they had a professional panel of industry insiders, and I wanted an evaluation of how the work stood up. And although I did not place, each entry got feedback from these industry insiders, and they wrote back and said, hey, this was a really good story. We liked the way it flowed. It really keyed me in on some insights that I weren't aware of, and that's what I was looking for.
Now, without giving away any spoilers, can you tell us something about maybe one of your favorite scenes in the book or scene you wrote that was very important to you?
Okay, there were two scenes that were important to me. The first scene that I wrote was the scene where the Marines are gathering together at the base theater, and they're preparing to get on the bus, which is going to take them to the airfield so they can get on the plane to go to Kuwait. And while they're in this formation, the first sergeant is conducting a roll call, and several Marines arrive to the formation late. And so the first sergeant stops what he's doing, and he addresses the delinquent Marines and expresses to them the gravity of the situation. And the reason why I found this scene very important to me was because up until this time, it wasn't real. You know, it's like, okay, they can solve this diplomatically. It'll be resolved. You know, this is not happening. But once you step on that bus and you realize, okay, we're leaving the base and we're actually going to the airfield, you realize, hey, this is for real. Now, I have to take you back in time to make the listener aware that this was 2003, okay? The U.S. hadn't been in a major military conflict since 1991, which was the first Gulf War. Okay, so that's over a 10-year period that we had been in relative peace. And so this was a mass mobilization at the time. My battalion, which had 350 members in it, only had 5 Marines that had combat experience. So you begin to question, hey, am I trained for this? Am I going to be able to do what I got to do? You know, all these things start playing on your mind. So that was one of my favorite scenes. And then the second scene that had special meaning to me was when Ollie, my Humvee driver, in the story comes to realization that taking unnecessary risk to obtain medals and rewards is not necessarily the best course of action for him or for those around him. So those were my two favorite scenes.
Now, why write this book? Why now?
Okay. That's funny that you should ask this. Actually, this book is close to 10 years old. I wrote it in 2003, and I financed it with money that I received for combat pay while I was in the desert. The original publication was in 2004, and two things happened as I was putting this book together and getting ready to publish it that put this book on the back burner. The first thing that happened was Jessica Lynch's story came out. And for you listeners that don't recall, Jessica Lynch was the female soldier that was captured in Nasiriyah, and she was taken prisoner, and then she was later rescued by a special operations team. So that kind of discouraged me right there. And then the second thing is, this is whole new territory for me, writing a book and then taking it to market. So I had no idea about advertising and what that entailed and how to go about it. I had just left the Marine Corps. I entered the civilian workforce. I didn't have any job. I'm looking for a job. So I really didn't have the funds or the know-how to know how to go about advertising. So what ended up happening was that got put on the back burner. I worked a couple of jobs, went back to school. Fast forward 7 years later, I'm having a conversation with a good writer friend of mine named Sherry Johnson, and she had just released her book, her first book, last year. And so I was talking to her. I was like, you know, I'd like to get back into writing again. And she asked me, well, do you have any work that I could look at? And I was like, well, you know, I got this book that I wrote way back when. She said, okay, well, is there a digital version of it? I was like, no, because back in 2004, nobody could foresee how e-books were going to transcend the market, so there was no digital version. So finally I managed to get her a copy, a hard copy of the book. She read it. She came back to me and said, man, this is really good. You ought to look into converting this from a hardcover book into a digital format. And I kind of put it off, and I was like, well, you know, let me go ahead and let me just start the book, you know, and then we'll just let that one go, and we'll just start. And she kept at it. She kept at it. And so finally I thought, okay, I'll make a digital format for the book. So I went around and I searched for companies that were experienced in taking a hardcover copy book and converting it to a digital format. So that right there explains the difference in covers, because if you get the paperback book, you're going to have one cover, and if you get the digital format, it's a different cover. And
right.
The reason being is because there's been so many advances in the 8 years since that book was written that I was able to do a lot more in the digital format. So, again, this is not really a new book. It's basically a re-release.
Okay. Now, let me just ask you, is the main character in this book you, or is he based off of you or someone you know?
The main character is me, other than those three liberties I told you about, changing the rank to corporal, because at the time I was a sergeant, changing the job from logistics planner to heavy equipment operator, and then changing my siblings from brothers to sisters. So I chose the name John Archer because it was a lot easier to write John Archer than Matt did this, Matt did that, because what I had to do is I had to disassociate myself from what I was doing in order to focus on the big picture. If I was constantly writing Matt this, Mike that, Matt that, it would have come off as arrogant. So I had to do that in order to make the story work.
No, that makes sense. That totally makes sense. Now, what do you hope to accomplish with this novel? What do you hope people will get out of it?
What I hope to accomplish with this novel is to give the general public an added awareness or an insight into the life and complexities of the average service member on the battlefield in the 21st century, to boil it down to the smallest component. Basically, what is it like to go to war is what I was trying to achieve.
Okay. Now, where can people find out more about the book?
The book can be found on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. If you like trailers, you can go to CircleOf7Productions.com and they have a trailer for the book. It's available both in paperback and digital versions. And again, there's a slight discrepancy in the covers. If you get the digital version, you'll have one cover. If you get the paperback version, you'll have another cover.
Now, Matt, can you tell us just a little bit more about yourself?
Okay. I'm a former Marine. I spent 8 years in the Marine Corps from 1996 to 2003. For those of you that are quick with math, you're going to like, hey, that's only 7 years. Well, the reason why is because in the Marine Corps, after the third year, if you plan to stay in the Marine Corps, they come and ask you, say, are you staying in or are you getting out? And you have to compete to remain in. So they give you that year to compete against your fellow peers to retain a slot to remain in the Marine Corps. So I actually ended up reenlisting on the third year. So technically, chronologically, it's 7 years, but when you're talking to regular folks, it's 2 tours, 8 years. I attended Georgia College and State University. I hold a Bachelor of Science in History, and I currently, as employment, I'm a document analyst for a large physician's practice group in Augusta, Georgia.
Oh, very good. Now, do you think that you're going to write anything else in the future, or is this it? This is your baby?
No. I'm definitely going to write something more in the future. I almost feel compelled to write a second book because I don't want to be typecast as, oh, that military writer. In fact, I just completed a 2-year apprenticeship program in which I was paired with a published author to learn the craft from the ground up. I did this because I felt I personally needed to learn as much about the craft as possible. In the Marine Corps, we have 11 leadership principles, and one of those principles is a Marine is technically and tactically proficient. And what that means is that a Marine, regardless of his job, whether he's a cook or a mechanic, he is the resident expert in his field. So in my mind, if I'm going to put future work out there, I owe it to my readers to develop the best possible product I can. And in order for me to do that, I need to know things like, you know, what's the relationship of plot to theme to emotional character development? What's the difference between single viewpoint stories and multi-viewpoint stories? What's the percentage of narration to dialogue to action in a standard commercial novel? I can't rely on talent instinct anymore. I have to learn the craft. So that's what I've been busy with the last 2 years. I currently don't have anything coming out now, but I am working on a second novel. It's a crime drama with a female protagonist. It's going to be about 31 chapters long, and I am currently on chapter 10. And I hope to finish up or wrap up sometime in 2013.
Well, that's fantastic news. I'm glad to hear that you're pursuing it. I think that's fantastic. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight, Matt. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Sheila. It was a pleasure talking to you and your audience.
And I want to thank our listeners for joining us here at Readers Entertainment Radio. Don't forget that you can go to www.readersentertainment.com, and we'll have the podcast there. We'll have a small blog with some URLs so that you can find the books. And, you know, feel free to share your stories, share your comments, and leave questions. If you do that, we'll make sure that we let Matt know so he can come over and read those and answer any of those. And I'm Sheila English, your host, and happy reading.
This show brought to you by Circle of Seven Productions, www.cosproductions.com. Please be sure to subscribe, and welcome to our circle.
Glamour, celebrity, and murder. Whether you're looking for mystery or suspense, you'll find it all at Thriller Fast. Open to readers, aspiring writers, and published authors. Learn craft, meet top thriller writers, and enjoy New York City July 11th through the 14th. Jack Higgins, R.L. Stine, Lee Child, Karen Slaughter, Catherine Coulter, Richard North Patterson, John Sanford, and Rule, and more. Join them this summer. Find out more at www.thrillerfest.com.